From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson talks about the threat ISIS poses to the United States and why he stands with President Obama's order for airstrikes in Iraq. Then filmmakers Chris Emmons and Sam Cozell made their most recent movie here for a good reason.
You tell someone you're a filmmaker in L.A., they just nod their head and glaze over. But here in Milwaukee, people still get excited. Still people really get jazzed and get this extra sense of excitement that you don't see out in L.A.
And a play about a Marine coming home from war explores themes that apply to all of us.
Who am I now? Now that my life circumstances are different, who am I now? Where do I go from here? And what is my value? What is my worth in society?
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. Warplanes from the U.S. and other allied countries are continuing to strike at targets in Syria and Iraq. They're part of the effort to turn back territorial gains made by members of the group Islamic State, known as ISIS or ISIL. The military response comes without a congressional authorization for war, but it is eliciting backing from many in Congress who've opposed President Obama's foreign policy in the past. Yesterday on national television, Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan offered his support for military strikes. Meanwhile, President Obama himself appeared on CBS's 60 Minutes Sunday evening and said his administration had underestimated the threat posed by ISIS and overestimated the Iraqi army's ability to defend the country. Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson has been engaged in the issue as well, both as an elected official and now as an appointed U.S. representative at the United Nations. He joins us on the line this morning. Senator Johnson, thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning.
In your opinion, how significant a threat is ISIS to the West and specifically to the United States?
It's a very real threat. I mean, significance, you know, I don't know exactly what their operational capability ought to be, and we've certainly improved our defenses, but it's a very real threat, and it's something that I agree with President Obama, the goal that he stated, which was to degrade and ultimately destroy or defeat ISIS. And I think that's a goal that we should be pursuing in as robust a fashion as possible.
Well, what is your take then on the president's statement on 60 Minutes that we had underestimated ISIS? You agree?
Well, I believe his administration certainly underestimated it. I'm not sure that's true to the intelligence community or others, but I think probably everybody was caught by surprise at how easily ISIS was able to grab territory and displace the Iraqi security forces. I think that's true. But, it was unfortunate that President Obama, when ISIS basically took over in Fallujah back in January of 2014, at the time, I think President Obama was just denying reality. I mean, he referred to ISIS as the JV team. They're nothing of the sort. And I think other people really looking at that understood that they were not the JV team. It was a real clear and present danger. But, you know, we ignore that threat and we see the results.
Well, the president also said that his administration overestimated Iraq's ability to defend itself. Do you think that that's true? Is that a fair assessment?
Well, again, if President Obama said they overestimated it, I would agree they overestimated it. I think what you really need to take a look at is, you know, could have this been prevented? I believe it could have. I think the historic blunder that President Obama made was in not leaving a stabilizing force behind to give the coalition government the space it needed to work things out politically in Iraq. America and our military presence there was the glue that held that coalition government together. And when America pulled out, again, very, very ill-advised policy on President Obama, that glue was removed and the coalition government really dissolved almost immediately. Maliki was concerned about the Sunnis. He removed Sunnis from his military, put in his place political cronies, and that's one of the reasons the military was also hollowed out. So hopefully President Obama has learned from that mistake and will begin to realize that, and he's certainly sounding like he's beginning to realize that America is the indispensable nation when it comes to providing stability in so many regions of the world.
But do you worry that by doing this military action, we're actually playing into ISIS's hands, and that this is actually what they want us to do and why they picked this particular fight?
Well, I'm concerned about that, and it's a question I've certainly asked myself. I actually asked the president of Egypt when I met with him at the UN last week in New York. I don't believe the leaders of ISIS are stupid. And so by posting these videos on the Internet of these beheadings, they are trying to draw America in. I think the best explanation I've seen for it was written a column written by Charles Krauthammer, who basically theorized that one of the reasons they may be trying to draw us in is they realize that we won't have the staying power. That if they draw us in for battle, and they can withhold it. Now, and by the way, one of the reasons they're probably attracting foreign fighters would be to be fodder for American bombing and for military action. But if they can just hold out and kind of wear us down, tire us out, get the American public again or the world public war weary, then they emerge triumphant, just not losing. Is victory for ISIS, and then they end up being the preeminent Islamic terror group, and they become the caliphate. So I think that's probably the likely explanation of why they may be drawing America in. And so the mistake we would make is being drawn in and not achieving the goal that President Obama set, which is defeat the destruction of ISIS. So President Obama set that goal. He needs to be all in, fully committed to achieving that goal.
Well, how important are Arab nations, other Arab nations that are part of the current coalition that's working to battle ISIS? Are those partnerships key to winning both the actual war and the PR war?
It's crucial. And it's crucial on a number of different fronts. In order for America, the American public, to maintain the long-term support for what will be a long-term effort, this isn't going to be over in a couple of weeks or a couple of months or even a couple of years. I mean, Islamic terrorists have been at war with America since at least 1993 when they tried to bring down the Twin Towers. So this is not a long-term or short-term problem. It's a long-term problem. And so the only way the American public will support the long-term actions that will be required is if they see that the Arab nations are also fully engaged, fully committed, both militarily and financially, to the destruction of this ideology, destruction of these Islamic terrorists. And so it's absolutely crucial for what we need to do in the region long term.
Do you have faith that they will stick to it long term, that they won't be pulled by other, other factions and other interests?
Sure, it's a real concern. I mean, the Arab states have been very duplicitous in their actions for decades. And so we've kind of played both sides of the fence here. And that's one of the reasons I agree with President Obama's UN speech. His second point, after the degrading and defeat of ISIS, he said the world, particularly Muslim communities, must stand up and very vocally, very loudly reject and renounce this terrorist ideology. And I agree with him on that. And so we've got to continue to push and prod and do everything we can to pressure the Arab states to remain committed to not only the defeat of Islamic terror, but also the defeat of that ideology that accepts and promotes terror.
And what do you think are some of the best ways we could help promote that? Is that a diplomatic solution?
It is, and to a certain extent, the fact that President Obama did not start any bombing until there was enough pressure, for example, on the Iraqi government to replace Maliki, who was a terrible leader, and force a true coalition government in Iraq, to a certain extent, holding off that leadership until that moment, I think you'd have to say at least worked to put in place a government, coalition government in Baghdad that has a chance for success. So we have a real conundrum here. If America leads too much, the Arab states will sit back and say, okay, well, America's going to protect us like they have for decades. If we don't lead enough, they won't fully commit themselves because they'll be in great danger. So it's a very fine line that President Obama has to walk. These are very complex issues right now, a very complex situation. I don't envy President Obama his task. That's why I've been trying to be as supportive as possible through positive reinforcement to strong and resolute action. I want to see this president succeed in his efforts to defeat ISIS and Islamic terror, because if he succeeds, America and Americans stay safe.
Well, there are also some who are concerned that the countries that we're working with, some of the Arab nations, have also worked to oppose Israel, who is an ally. How much does that matter in assembling this coalition and also maintaining the coalition?
Well, again, you're pointing out one of the difficult complexities of the situation and the duplicity on the part of many Arab states. And so from my standpoint, this is when Arab states, this is a moment of choosing for them. They have to reject Islamic terror. They've got to accept democracy and democracy movements, which includes Israel. I mean, Israel's a democratic state. It is flourishing in the Middle East, even in a very tough neighborhood. So I'd like to see the Arab states take a look at the success that Israel's economy is and try and duplicate that. Use all that oil wealth to diversify their economy so their young people have greater opportunity so they can get a well-paying job in an industry, as opposed to the only place they can get paid is through Islamic terror groups like ISIS.
Congress has not yet voted exactly to go to war, but one of the numbers that I saw from the Center on Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, which is an independent nonpartisan policy research institute, they've estimated that the airstrikes have already cost us between $780 million and $930 million since they began on the 8th of August. How do you balance fiscal responsibility and national security? That seems to me to be another conundrum.
Well, you have to recognize the top priority of the federal government is defense of our nation, keeping America safe and secure. And so when you start taking a look at what the federal government should spend its money on, how they should prioritize spending, having a strong and efficient and effective military is a top priority. So to deny the reality, to leave ourselves exposed, to make the decision that the way we're going to fight this war on terror, which, by the way, we don't choose whether we're at war with Islamic terror. They've already made that choice for us. Our only choice is, are we on defense or do we go on offense? Do we defend ourselves here at home and see acts of terror occur on American soil, or do we try and defeat it halfway around the world? I choose to be on offense. And so what I don't want to be is penny wise and pound foolish and look at these efforts and achieving the goal that, again, President Obama set, that I agree with, defeating ISIS, is a dollar and cents game. I'm looking at strategically in terms of what we must do to actually accomplish that goal.
Well, Senator Johnson, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today. I appreciate it very much.
I'm happy to do so. Appreciate your interest.
Ron Johnson is a Republican senator from Wisconsin. He spoke with me by phone from his Senate office in Washington. A Made in Milwaukee film gets its premiere at the Milwaukee Film Festival this week. We'll talk with the director and executive producer of Serial Daters Anonymous when Lake Effect returns right after this. Lake Effect returns now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The 2014 Milwaukee Film Festival is underway at cinemas from Fox Point to Washington Heights. One of the mainstays of the festival is the spotlight on local films. The Cream City Cinema showcases everything from shorts to documentaries to full-length feature films. One of the latter being screened this year is Serial Daters Anonymous, a movie completely filmed in Milwaukee, and most of the cast is also from here as well. The movie turns gender roles on their heads when Claire, after being jilted at her wedding, goes on a dating spree and chronicles her exploits in a very revealing and very public blog. As she goes on her dating rampage, it's unclear who's really being victimized. Chris Emmons wrote and directed Serial Daters Anonymous, and Sam Kozel is the film's executive producer. Emmons told Lake Effect's Dan Harmon how the film came to be.
It was something that I actually started writing when I was disenfranchised with my day job. No, I started writing it in about 2011, when I was not thrilled with my current situation working retail. I think a little bit of that made it into the script, but it turned into something quite a bit different.
Where did the idea itself come from? It seems to be a very female-centric idea.
Yeah, I think it's actually something that men and women do after getting kind of burned in a relationship. I think that, you know, a lot of people have the tendency to sort of lash out and, you know, take out their feelings in other people before they can get themselves straight again, unfortunately. And I just really felt that if it was a male, it would be the most boring movie in the world. But there's a lot of female roles that I think just haven't been made because there's a lot of, you know, women are still fighting having to play either, you know, mothers or the wife or the love interest or the damsel. Whereas like every male archetype in the history of archetypes has been played on the screen. So I was like, yeah, this is going to be interesting if it's a woman kind of, you know, taking out her frustrations with relationships on innocent guys.
Well, it was certainly fun to watch a woman turn the tables from what we're normally, well, I guess what we're used to seeing in films.
Good. I'm glad. Mm-hmm.
And Sam, where do you come in on the whole writing process and the whole movie, frankly?
Well, I read the script. For the most part, that's where I come in, and I like working with Chris because of those reasons, because he does write very strong female characters, and that's something that always interests me, because, oddly enough, it's kind of a thing that's not being done enough, and so I'm always trying to err on the side of originality and still breaking new boundaries sort of thing. And it's surprising that this day and age that's still a thing for women, and especially in cinema.
Yeah, Joss Whedon was once asked, why do you write such strong characters? And his response was, because you're still asking that question.
Maybe give us just an idea of your film background before this. I mean, this clearly would not be the first. If it is your first effort, then it's quite impressive.
It's not the first rodeo. I think Sam and I have both done a considerable amount of things we'll admit to and won't admit to. The first thing I admit to was sort of a loss of innocence comedy about a shampoo salesman in 2010 that I shot in Chicago called Shine Baby Shine. That one was pretty much no budget. I used my school's rental equipment and everything. And that was the first feature I admit to. And then I got out of college and I met Sam. And I think I called him like the day after I met him, and I literally embarrassingly told him, Sam, I like your brain. I would like to work with you. And then we just started drumming up ideas. And I know I complained to him about my day job every 5 seconds, and then I just started trying to escape by writing my way out of a corner and just making a lot of material. And this one seemed like it would be a good one for us to work on, you know, to kind of get ourselves further out there.
Do you still have that day job?
Negative.
Good. Glad to hear it. Sam, what about your history, I guess, in a nutshell?
I originally started out in video game design. I started a video game company when I was 17, and I ran that for 3 years. But then I got kind of sick of sitting on a computer all day, and I wanted to kind of get back to my first love, which was movies. And so I started doing that. Also, when I was 17, I worked at a movie studio here in Milwaukee called Lightning Rod. And they were doing low-budget horror films that would appear on, like, Netflix and Blockbuster. So that was, like, my first introduction into it. But then meeting Chris was a bizarre experience because it's one of those things where we feel like we've known each other for a longer period of time. I think we've only known each other for, like, almost 2 years or something. But
I want to say it's, like, three or four now, but maybe I'm wrong.
I feel like you're wrong because I feel like it's been much shorter. But
it feels longer.
It always, yeah. And so it's just surprising when you meet someone and you just kind of click and it's been we've been just doing great stuff ever since.
But yeah, we did before Serial Daters, we did a short film called Prone, and we used a lot of local actors. Mark Metcalf from before he moved away was in it. But that's it was sort of a proof of concept in a way, but it's a completely different film than Serial Daters. But we used a lot of the same crew and some of the same actors and things like that.
Same characters, too.
Is every actor in this film a Milwaukee actor? Is the crew also all from Milwaukee?
It's almost entirely. We have we got a couple actors from Chicago that came in, but it's mostly local. And then one of our LA actors is originally from Wisconsin, Sam Page. I think he went to Whitefish Bay High. So it was, I mean, he stayed with his parents when he was out here. And I think he drove his mom's car to set. And then...
So he made sacrifices.
Big sacrifices. And and then our lead actress is actually from Scotland, Louise Linton. You know, hopefully, you know, the accent sounded like it was not... But
I'm hearing this for the first time, and I did not even occur to me that she was from Scotland.
Fantastic news! Yeah. She's a great actress. I originally found her on this list online of upcoming actresses when I was trying to figure out who to cast, and I saw that she was represented by the same people that repped Jack Nicholson, and I was like, "What is this lady's deal? You know, what's going on?" So I reached out to her manager. And he initially told her to pass because we weren't financed yet. And then she loved the script so much that she emailed me and she was like, what's holding this film back? I'd love to do it. And so then I ended up flying out to L.A. and meeting her at a Cheesecake Factory.
Nice.
And, you know, we kind of talked there and she was really instrumental in actually helping us get everything else off the ground. So I think it's safe to say that we probably couldn't have done it without her.
Okay, so I say this not to self-aggrandize, but I've dabbled in short film. I know how much effort is required just to make something that's 6 minutes. So where did you get it in your minds to make that leap from a short film to a feature-length film, which is a huge undertaking?
I think you just have to... just in terms of getting somewhere, is that you can't just make short films your whole life. At least if you want to be in the real film industry, you got to keep moving up.
Yeah, I think it harkens back to the day job that we're discussing here. you can have a day job and shoot a short film on a weekend, and that can be your life. Or, you know, if you have a hunger for things greater. You know, your short film might be a proof of concept, or it might be something that shows, hey, I can do this, you can invest in me, and it'll be at least this good, probably more, because we'll probably have more money on a feature. So, you know, I think we tried to make some short material that would stand on its own, but also that would show what we are capable of doing at a low cost, to give people the idea of what we could do at a high cost. But, yeah, I think it's just one of those things where Sam and I are kind of do or die. And, you know, it's neither of us are doing the day job thing anymore. And we're just working constantly to continue making, you know, great work.
Well, tell me a little bit about if you want, about funding. What was the budget? And was it the usual kind of saga of trying to get funding and which comes first?
Well, I think originally we did the short film and we had a sponsor. Brewery Credit Union was able to sponsor that. And that's something that we used that short film then to generate more funding for the feature. And we did that by, we started a nonprofit movie studio called Film Freed, which I run currently. And that's allowed us to do significant fundraising in the nonprofit sector, as well as being able to get investors in. So for this movie, we had some sponsors, Intercontinental Hotel, Wicked Hop, both sponsored us, and MKE Production Rental allowed us to use a lot of their equipment. And so it wouldn't have been possible without them. But in terms of the actual dollar number, I guess we've decided not to discuss it. But it's a low budget, definitely a low budget film.
Okay. Something that it's always fun to watch local movies, because seeing Milwaukee as a set, basically. But I did notice there was no mention in the film that it is Milwaukee. Is that intentional, that they just wanted this to be everywhere urban America?
No, I'm not ashamed. It's I think that, you know, I certainly wanted it to be Milwaukee. And I wasn't trying to hide that at all. So, no, it wasn't intentional that nobody says the word Milwaukee. I guess it just there was no occasion for someone to say the word.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, there's a temptation to do that, right? If you're, if your funders are local and the actors are local and everything that about your life is in Milwaukee, to then make it not a, a mentionable central role in the movie.
Yeah. Maybe I naively thought that the skyline was just, you know, nationwide recognizable.
Yeah. I mean, I think that hopefully the audience would be curious enough to maybe question that and look on, look into it on their own, maybe.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, as a...
I mean, most movies don't mention it.
Right. But yeah, I just, you know, Milwaukee is so undershot and underplayed, so it's like a totally different texture that films are not used to shooting. So I was exhilarated to just like, you know, this bridge is not very often featured in film, if ever. And, you know, look at, you know, the beautiful skyline here. Look at the lake. People are going to be like, oh, where is this? You know, it's going to be more interesting than had it been New York or Cali or Chicago.
Well, as, I don't know, some would say the film industry is becoming decentralized from the West Coast and a lot more films are being shot around the country.
And that is very true. But California did just pass the upped to their tax incentives. So they're trying to, you know, cling on to the control, but it might be too far gone. We'll see.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the TV and big studio stuff, you know, people are always going to be shooting that kind of thing. But honestly, the tax incentives in other cities are outrageous, and I really don't see why they've gone away here.
Well, besides that, or maybe you want to talk about that a little more, but what were some obstacles or some benefits of filming in Milwaukee?
Benefit-wise, it's tremendously easy to work with people here. Everyone's always excited. What I always say about Milwaukee is that our greatest untapped resource for movies is magic, and so that's something that hasn't been tapped here. I mean, that's something that's been tapped in L.A. You know, you tell someone you're a filmmaker in L.A., they just nod their head and glaze over. But here in Milwaukee, people still get excited. Still, people really get jazzed and get this extra sense of excitement that you don't see out in L.A.
Yeah, and that enthusiasm actually carries through onto the screen, absolutely, because people put in extra effort. But, yeah, I mean, there's just beautiful, beautiful crews here, people that are just so passionate about their craft, you know, whereas other places they might do it all the time and, you know, it's just another job. But these people that we were working with, like every single crew member was, you know, so committed to getting everything right. And we had a short schedule, but people were just, we were spoiled. They're beautiful.
And how long did it take, would you say, from inception to your first screening?
Like a year and some change.
Inception meaning writing or
yep,
pre-production?
Writing.
Well, longer than.
Yeah, that would be about 3 years.
Three years, yeah.
I wrote the script and I you know, I didn't exactly know what to do because I knew I couldn't do it at the same level of like the budgetless, you know, films I'd done before. And I was trying to, you know, make something bigger. And then, you know, I started talking to Sam about it. And we kind of thought, like, you know, maybe jumping into this feature is going to be a little difficult. So maybe we should do a short.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of why I just went off one afternoon and I wrote the short film Prone. And we did that and, you know, made some good connections there. And then, yeah, we sort of rode the coattails of that into somehow putting together the feature.
Obviously, you're going to want to do the film festival circuit. Is that right? I mean, you're approaching other festivals, and that's always an ongoing process.
Yeah, that process is ongoing. We're still kind of, you know, we really wanted to premiere it in Milwaukee because everybody worked on it here. It was shot here. We wanted people to see it here first, but we're still kind of targeting where else we're going to show it. So, yeah, we'll keep that. You know, if you go to our Facebook page, we'll keep all the information coming out there, but... Yeah, our next screening is actually, it's
Wednesday, the 1st at 4 p.m. at Oriental. It's the only show that's not sold out, so it's really the only chance that anybody who's interested to kind of come out and see it.
Okay. Well.
Yeah, and then aside from that, I think there's rush tickets at the door at 7 p.m. Friday at the Times. But yeah, if you want advanced tickets and you want to know if they can get in the Oriental at 4 on Wednesday the 1st.
So your film is essentially a sellout. I mean, it's going to be sold out. Not that you're sellouts, but the film is sold out.
Working on it. Working on being a sellout.
All right.
Well, the first and last screenings are.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So then what is the end goal here? I mean, do you want to stay in Milwaukee and make film, or do you want to go bigger and better, if you will?
For me, I like staying here in Milwaukee. I mean, I know he likes the LA scene, but as far as what I do with Film Freed, is that the idea is to try to be those tax incentives by being a nonprofit and be able to try to attract outside business from LA to come to Milwaukee and film here. And until I feel like I've tried everything here in Milwaukee, I'm going to do my best to help build the movie and film scene here with my company.
Yeah, I adore shooting in Milwaukee, and I want to continue to. I'm just sort of doing my jail time in LA right now. You know, trying to make all the connections so that I can get out of there and do my work and have the people that I'm going to work with and, you know, have the proper network so that I, don't have to live there anymore. It's certainly not my favorite place in the world. But, you know, the problem is, we're still trying to grow things here in Milwaukee. And I, of course, want to continue to shoot here, but part of the growth is going to come from convincing people on the other coast that this is a magical place to shoot. And so hopefully, you know, we can convince more and more productions to come here, start to generate more money in the film scene here, and hopefully get those tax incentives reinstated.
Well, Sam and Chris, thank you for coming in. Congratulations on finishing this film. It was a lot of fun to watch.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Chris Emmons is the director and screenwriter of Serial Daters Anonymous. Sam Kozel is the film's executive producer. The movie screens as part of the Cream City Cinema Spotlight at this year's Milwaukee Film Festival. There are two more screenings of the film, and there's more information about when and where at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, a Marine comes back from Iraq and isn't quite ready to go home. The people she meets who help her on her way make up the story of the play Welcome Home, Jenny Sutter. It's on stage now at Next Act Theater, and we'll talk with the show's director when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. From the Iliad to Henry V, from All Quiet on the Western Front to War Horse and Black Watch, the stage is a powerful place to show what happens to men in the cauldron of war. It's now a place to show what happens to women as well. Women have always been affected by war, of course, and some have historically been warriors alongside their brethren. But it's far more recently that women have been part of organized militaries and have been officially on the front lines with their male counterparts. And their stories are now finding their way onto the stage. What happens to one such woman, a Marine returning from a tour of duty in Iraq, is the basis of the play Welcome Home, Jenny Sutter. It's currently on stage at the Next Act Theater. Deborah Staples directed the show, and she joins me in the studio now. Deborah, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for coming in this morning.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Welcome Home, Jenny Sutter is the play that is currently just opened this last weekend at Next Act Theater, and it is about a Marine coming home from war. But it is so much more than that. And let's start with the play itself. What attracted you to this particular script, say, over any other play dealing with the same subject?
The play never left my mind once I read it, and I found that it was in my mind more strongly after 2 weeks than it was right at the start. It really changed the way I moved through the world and how I saw people, my own children, people on the street, everybody I came in contact with. And if that's what a piece of theater or a piece of art can do, I can't think of a higher compliment.
And that was just from reading it?
Yes, just from reading it.
That's pretty powerful.
It's very powerful. I really felt that my story, a piece of my story, pieces of truth from my life were represented in this script in a very powerful way. And I thought, oh, that's just particular to me. As it turned out, it was particular to everybody I gave the script to, all the actors. They found it personal to them as well. It's a very interesting thing, the way it makes you feel seen. It makes you feel heard. It makes you feel like your story has been validated by being shown to the community, by being put on stage or on the page even.
And that's true even if you are not a veteran returning from war.
No, I'm certainly not a veteran. And I actually don't have that many people that are close to me that are veterans. So in a way, it was sort of the personal aspect of me feeling heard and validated and my story being out there and things that I could relate to. Having that sort of balm on my soul then enabled me to unlock this sort of secret room that I didn't know existed, sort of a storehouse of love and empathy that I didn't even know was there. For other people, top of the list would be veterans coming home, people that you meet on the street. They're somewhat invisible in our society. We want them to be okay, and they become invisible oftentimes. And this script says, look at the experience that is there. Acknowledge it. See these people. One of the most powerful things, I think, is the simple words, I see you. We all want to have our stories acknowledged, seen, validated. And extending that to other people is one of the most important things that we can do. I now find that when I'm meeting somebody, it's hard to get in a twist about something that someone does when you are looking at that person not as just what is presented before you, but as a person with a world of experience and circumstances that you have no idea about. Then you start to say, I'm not going to reduce this person to this one behavior, this one experience, this one interaction that I have in front of me. Who knows where all of this is coming from? Who knows why they are reacting the way they are to things? You have to give people credit for the world of experience that they have lived.
Let's set up the basic story without giving too much away. Tell me about Jenny Sutter and how her story has become for you this universal story.
Jenny Sutter is a female Marine coming home from a tour of duty, and she is injured physically, and she is injured psychologically, emotionally, and she knows enough to know that she can't go home right away. There's a wonderful quote by the psychologist Edward Tick. The path back from war is a lot longer and more difficult than the path to it. So we see this female Marine. Of course, we have a lot more women in the military these days than we used to. And seeing active duty and coming home with trauma, injuries. And what does it mean when the mom is coming home injured? It adds a whole nother dimension to the question of a service person being able to step right back into the life that they left, like nothing has happened, which is what we kind of expect from our service men and women coming home, to make up for lost time, to pick up their responsibilities, to just go on and be okay. So we see a woman who's not quite ready to do that. I think a lot of us can relate to what Jenny Sutter is going through, because she is asking herself the questions, who am I now? Now that my life circumstances are different, who am I now? Where do I go from here? And what is my value? What is my worth in society? And those are questions that we all ask ourselves, even if it's something joyous like the birth of a child. Now I'm a different person in the world. I'm a mom, or I'm an older person than I used to be, or I lost a job, or whatever the experience is, lots of common experiences where you find yourself saying, I'm not the same person as I was anymore. So now who am I?
What do I do now?
What do I do now?
Yeah.
It's the most human experience. And as we go through our lives, we'll probably ask ourselves that many, many times. But when you have the sort of intense pressure cooker of someone who has devoted their life to service of their country and to service of the people that they are serving with. And they are in a situation where they are getting an intense adrenaline rush the entire time that they're working. It becomes a life mission that maybe some of us may approach, but in such an intense way to come out of that and say, now you're going to leave behind all the people that were your support system, all the people that you were living and working for and with, and your sort of mission in life, that's all gone. And what you were left with are some injuries, some trauma, and the need to just be okay and go on. Those are incredible questions to answer under those circumstances.
Well, and the play does it in such a way that is incredibly humorous, too.
Right.
There is a lot. I was laughing out loud reading it in places because it was just – the dialogue was so perfect. And I knew who these people were.
You do, don't
without
you?
Going yes. into – again, without giving too much away, she falls in with a group of people that she needs to fall in with to allow her to move on by
yes.
the end of the play. And those people are amazing.
The people,
those characters are so much fun.
The people – and really they're what drew me to the piece first because I am all of those kooky people. They're the people that you are in your worst nightmare, and also it's the best of us. It's stripped away all of the keeping up with the Joneses and trying to keep the professional guys on of, yes, I'm doing great. I can do it all. I can be have a career. I can be a mom. And I can do it all with style and grace. And this strips it away and says, no, we're all just kind of kooky, bumbling people trying to do the best we can with whatever we happen to be carrying with us. So these people are – they are – they're funny, and I respect them so much because they have suffered incredible things in their own lives and they don't sit in it. They don't sit in it. They're looking out and saying, what can I do for someone else? Look, this Jenny is hurting. What can we do for her? There's something incredibly human and stripped down and raw about it, just this desire to help.
What has been the reaction so far from audiences? Because you've had one weekend now.
Yes.
You opened last week.
Yeah.
So what are people – are they getting what they expect from the show?
No. No, the veterans that I have talked to that have seen the show, people that I don't necessarily have a relationship with, they say three things to me. First being, this is not what I expected it was going to be. The second is, thank you so much for telling the story. And the third is some little bit of truth that they have in their lives that they saw resonate on the stage. So there was something in the play that they really understood and felt was part of their own story, though it might not be the exact situation. There was something parallel. So they were finding truth in it. That's incredibly gratifying to me. Lots of other people say, I can't believe how funny it is and heartbreaking and heartwarming.
All at the same time.
All at the same time. And people love this sort of love affair that goes on between some of the characters that live in Slab City, these imperfect people just trying to make connections with each other and very, I guess, human and unromanticized love between people.
And that's a good word for it, the unromanticized, because the whole play, it's unromanticized, but it's not a downer.
It's not a downer, and it's not
clear-eyed.
Sentimental.
It's not. That's it. It's
yeah.
not sentimental.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's nothing to be scared of is the thing. It's we don't go in and it's not some lesson on how what we should be doing and the right way to do things. It kind of says, look, I don't know the right way to do this. This is just a question we have in our society. How do we take care of people? How do we take care of each other? And it just takes it down to a human level. It gets rid of all the stuff that usually gets in the way, like our own egos, our own fears of things that we don't understand, our own need to push forward and make ends meet, and we can't stop and be bothered by having to tend to all these different issues. So it's interesting how it just strips all that away and it just says, I don't know how to do it, but let's give it a try.
Right, and tell a good story.
And
while
tell a good story.
It. Yeah.
And tell a good story.
The polemics are gone. There's
yes.
Yeah, there doesn't seem, and this is something I appreciated in reading it, is there doesn't seem to be any kind of agenda.
There isn't.
Other than let's connect with these people.
That's right.
On stage. And these people have stories. And one of the most affecting relationships for me was the one between Jenny and Donald. And
yes,
the story that we learned, this is getting towards the end of the play, but he is somebody that is not really welcomed in some ways in this little community, but he finds a way to connect with her that's really, really crucial. And you see him in one way in some scenes, and then you see him in another way, and you say, well, yeah, that's kind of all of us, isn't it? We all have our sides.
We all have our sides. And the wonderful thing is it has been so helpful, ironically, to this community that somebody with all of these troubles and all of this weight that they are carrying came and stayed with them. They are better for it. They, in help trying to help her, she ended up helping them. And it's a wonderful cycle that can go forward and ripple out. We see the effects of PTSD in the person who has it. And then there are a lot of people that believe that you also begin to see that PTSD in their close family members, and it ripples out. And in this play, we see even imperfect kindnesses ripple out.
Is that what you hope people get from it when they come to see it, that kindness is really kind of at the basis of everything?
I think so. I think so. And love seeing people. I don't want people to be going through our society, our community, invisible. None of us should be invisible. We all have a story. In talking to the playwright, it's a lovely woman, I asked her what her hope would be. And she said, I hope that people start to see everybody as the same, that it erases the barrier between us and them. And I think this play successfully does that. It allows us to see veterans as people with problems that in some tiny little way we can relate to, and allow them what they need to move back into the mainstream culture from where they have been.
How has it changed you as a director?
Well, I have never directed before.
Oh, so it's brand new. Wow.
It changed me a lot.
Talk about jumping right in.
Yeah, it was sort of a big first thing to attempt. I wanted to tell this story so badly, and the play changed me so much that I wanted to have a hand in telling this story. And as a director, I would have to say I learned a whole lot. There was a lot to learn here. One of the things that I'm really proud of learning is just simply more about our veterans, because that is not something that I have day-to-day contact with in my life, these issues on a firsthand basis. I am one of the many people who go about my life knowing that we've been at war, and it doesn't really affect me on a day-to-day basis. I just take for granted that that's going on, and I can move through my day no problem. I have been really, really glad to have a good reason to study up on this and become more educated as a citizen in the kindest way. It has really opened my eyes.
And I assume that's going to be true for your acting as well in future roles.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the reasons I love theater, is because it does open up all these different worlds. We never stop learning about anything, about human nature, but also about all of the worlds in which our characters live. That's one of the great joys of what we do.
Oh, absolutely. And then for the audience, too, to be able to inhabit that world for an hour and a half or two.
Absolutely.
A night, yeah.
Especially a fun, kooky world like this.
Yeah, and it is fun and kooky, I have to say. I want to go.
Please,
you know,
do.
I was like,
please,
you know, not to the play, although that too. Oh. I want to go to Slab City.
Oh, I know. I know. It's fascinating, isn't it?
I was thinking, is that real? I want to go.
It is real.
Yeah.
It is real. And it's the culture of it is certainly changing as it's become a little bit more famous, as it's worked its way into different works of art. The general public is becoming more aware of it, and there are pilgrimages there. And it seems like every decade or two, the culture has changed a little bit, but it would still be a really fascinating place to go.
Yeah, it certainly would. But in the short term, the play.
Go to the play.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And experience it, at least one version of it on stage.
Indeed.
So, well, Deborah, I want to thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you so much.
Deborah Staples is the director of Welcome Home, Jenny Sutter. It's currently playing at Next Act Theater, and it runs through October 12th. There's more information on our website, wuwm.com/lake effect. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North, thanking you again, as always, for tuning in. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.